East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Laura Dean Friedrich. We're going to be talking about advocacy for children. Laura Dean, can you hear me?
Good afternoon, Steve. How are you?
We're talking with you from your home in Chicago, I believe.
That is correct.
How did you first get interested in child advocacy?
Well, I think there are two or three different paths that took me to child advocacy. One was one of my first jobs out of college. I worked at a social service agency in Chicago that served the Latino community. And in that job, I ended up working in a child care program. And when you work in child care for low-income families, you run into advocacy very quickly. There's the advocacy that you do as you try to help families get the services that they need and the things they need to support their families and to take care of their children. But then there are the larger advocacy issues, some of them related to funding for the program so that you can continue to provide the services the families need, because these were all low-income working families. But then there's the advocacy that goes beyond that, which is trying to address some of the issues that impact the lives of those families. So that's sort of a beginning point. I left this agency, Casa Central, several years later, went to work at an agency that served children in a variety of ways. That agency is called ChildServe. And there I worked with churches, helping churches think about the needs of children, think about their resources for service, and then help them develop programs that serve children in their communities. And the more I worked with churches, the more I worked with good people in those congregations to serve children, the more convinced I became that part of the calling, part of the ministry with children, was to advocate, again, on those bigger issues, the things that affect the quality of life of children in all communities across the state and across the country. And then finally, at some point I began to realize that this work that I was doing with children and this sort of sense of needing to be involved in advocacy on their behalf, that embedded in that was actually God's call to ministry, that God was saying, Laura Dean, this is what I have for you, advocacy for children. It's not just the work you do from Monday to Friday in the workplace, but it's the ministry, it's the vocation for your life. So that's how I got involved in child advocacy.
Now you are also a mother and grandmother.
I am. My husband and I have a daughter, and she and her husband have presented us two beautiful grandsons. One is 4 and one is 2, almost 2. He'll be 2 in 2 weeks.
And along with Diane Olson, you've just co-authored a book called Weaving a Just Future for Children, an Advocacy Guide. And this is published by the United Methodist Publishing House, just out, and I've enjoyed reading it. What drew you to trying to provide a written resource for people who also would be interested in advocating for children, particularly through churches?
Well, Diane and I have been colleagues for a number of years. She is a clergy person and has served churches in Chicago and now is actually in the Minneapolis area. And I serve in churches as a volunteer, as a layperson. And we did a lot of workshops around children's issues and children's ministries and how to be an advocate for children and families. We did some of those together. Some of them we did, you know, separately in different places. And one day Diane said to me, you know, we should write a book about child advocacy. The church really needs to, to hear this message about child advocacy, and we can't do workshops for everybody. We should write a book.
Sure.
And I said, sure, that's a great idea, and went on with my busy life. And one day Diane came back and said, we should write a book. And that time we actually sat down and developed an outline, wrote a first chapter, sent it off to Discipleship Resources, which is one of the United Methodist publishing arms, and they were interested, and so then we wrote a book.
And you've chosen to start with theology, and you could have started many, many different places. Why did you start with actually how to think about God or the process of thinking about God?
Well, again, I think that springs out of what I said earlier about, you know, in all the work that I was doing with children, finding this call of God to ministry in the midst of the service work and the advocacy work that I was doing with children. And we wanted people who read our book to really understand that advocacy is a part, that it springs out of our faith, and that it is a part of our discipleship. And that it's not something separate. It's not something that people do in the secular realm separately from what they do in the spiritual realm in their lives of faith and discipleship. So that's why we thought it was really important to start with theology, to talk about what it means to be created in the image of God and what it means for God to come to us as a child and what it means for us to respond to God's call to justice. And it just seems that when you talk to people of faith, you start there and make the case or present the theological perspective, as well as, you know, point people to the various places in the biblical stories that point out God's action on behalf of all humanity, but also God's action and the ministry of Christ with children, because there's story after story after story. And we know these stories so well, many of them. These are stories that we have heard all of our lives, those of us who grew up in the church. And yet the stories take on another dimension when you begin to think, oh, that person is an advocate for that child or that group of children, and that advocacy is something that is richly embedded in all of our faith stories, both the biblical stories as well as the faith stories that we have in our personal lives and in our congregations. So that's why we started with theology.
Now, as a Protestant Christian, a Methodist layperson as you are, it's perhaps understandable why you would begin there, but you get very quickly in this book, and I know in your professional life you're a very skilled political lobbyist and educator, and you understand the political processes in the state of Illinois very well and know who to talk to and who has power and who can make decisions. How does that merge with where you begin, with theology and the Bible?
Well, you see, I think that churches are very good in some of the things that, I mean, they're very good at some of the things they do. For example, churches are very good at proclamation, about proclaiming the good news of Christ and saying this is for all people, and teaching and, you know, educating people in the congregation. They're also very good at recognizing needs that they see around them. And so churches then have usually two responses. One response is stewardship. They give money. They see a need, whether it's a natural disaster or a family that's just lost everything because there's a fire, or some children at a nearby school who need tutoring services. So they give money to those things. Or they develop a program themselves. And so many churches have food pantries or child care programs or programs for the elderly, or they're involved in tutoring, both either in their own church buildings or in school buildings. They do after-school programs in the summer. So there's this direct service component. So they recognize a need. They either respond through their gifts, their financial gifts, or they respond by giving themselves. They develop a program. What is harder, I think, for people in the average local church to think about is the implications those needs have in the public policy arena. So that if a church is very involved in, they're very concerned about hunger, for example, and many churches are. And so there are various ways that churches live that out. They might walk in a walk where they raise money that goes to hunger ministries. They might start a food pantry. They might support a food pantry. They might have a community meal once a week or twice a week or every day of the week. But the other thing they can do is then begin to think about the hard question, why are there hungry people in our community? And that takes you to public policy, because then you start thinking about what are the systems and the communities that we live in, and what are the legislative things that are happening that relate to this ministry that we're involved in on behalf of people who are hungry or people who are poor or children who can't read or teenagers who don't have productive activities to be involved in the summer. So that's why, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, actually, was to try to help people make the connection between the kind of direct service and stewardship parts of advocacy that they do in their local churches quite naturally to the harder questions around what we can do as citizens, as residents, as voters, as constituents of elected officials, both at the local level as well as all other levels of government in our country.
And your book provides very practical advice on how to effectively get your perspective across when you're talking to a legislator, when you're writing a letter to a newspaper, all those things. So it's very helpful in that way. The book we're talking about is called Weaving, A Just Future for Children. It's an advocacy guide, and we're talking with one of the co-authors, Laura Dean Friedrich, today here on Keeping the Faith. Let me remind listeners, this is a live call-in program, and we're delighted to have people join this conversation. So if you have comments, questions, a story to tell, give us a call in Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates here on WILL. The number is 333-WILL, 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call, do use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-WILL, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back for a moment, if we can, Laura Dean, to the point you were making about where you started this book and where you started personally with theology. After, in the section, in the first chapter or so, you talk about people, children, being made in the image of God in the sense of moral and spiritually. And then you have a section called Incarnation. And your first sentence I'd like to read, knowing that all children are created in God's image, it is possible to see and know God by seeing and knowing children. Tell me some more about that.
Well, I think that the creation stories in Genesis certainly are the first place that we hear the word that God created humanity in God's own image, and that we reflect that image spiritually. Throughout the books of the what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, there's this continuing story about the relationship between God and the people that God has created, and the ebb and flow of that relationship, faithfulness, and then times when they strayed away, times when they acted in ways that did not please God, and then God brought them back. They would be redeemed. They would repent and come back. When God sends Christ, we have a new understanding of the covenant between God and humanity, because Jesus, first of all, comes to us as a child, which is, all humanity starts out that way, but I suspect there were other options available to our Creator, but instead, Jesus comes to us as a child, so we have that witness, if you will, or that example, if you will. But in the Gospels, there's this wonderful place where the disciples are having a discussion about who's the greatest. And Jesus' answer to that question, he doesn't answer them directly, but instead he brings a child. And he brings a child into the circle where they're all sitting together, and he basically says that whoever welcomes a child welcomes the Christ, and that if we want to be like Christ, we must become like a child. And so one of the things that Diane and I believe quite firmly is that when we look into the face of a child, we need to understand that we're seeing the face of Christ. One of the names that Christ is called in the Bible is Emmanuel, God with us. And so children are to constantly remind us of the love of God and the presence of Christ in our lives.
Let me take a moment and read something that was published back in 2001 in the National Catholic Reporter. It's a short poem, about 100 words, called God with Us. And when I read the sentence that I quoted from your very recent book, just out this year, it's possible to see and know God by seeing and knowing children, I couldn't help but be reminded of this poem because, I'll admit, I wrote it. So it makes the same point but draws a somewhat different conclusion. See what you think of this. God with us. If Jesus, born of Mary, shows us God most clearly, if the baby Jesus in some real sense is God, then a child is God, and we can see God by watching children. But Shakespeare's mewling, puking infant does not seem especially godlike. Babies need a lot of care at both ends. A child is dependent, weak, dumb, and quite full of greed. So if our God is like a child, we then must be adults, responsible, aware, and work to feed, to clothe, to teach, to clean, to love unconditionally, to share ourselves. Imagine, not a king or wild avenging warrior, but, my God, a child. So that was that was my take on that that image of seeing God by seeing children, and yet children can be, you know, kind of selfish and nasty. And if God's like, if we can see God in a child, then we have to, as be adults and take care of these children. So what do you think of that?
Well, I think there are certainly places that we could point to in the biblical stories in which we would think God is not such a wonderful God, that there are some mean, hard things about
sure.
God, certainly.
Sure.
But in terms of children, I think that, the other side is that children also care for us.
Yeah.
And they're, children, and there's certainly some stories throughout the book in which the child is the one that really sees the truth or really is able to point to God because of this kind of spontaneity of a child and the kind of, openness to spiritual, mysterious things that we adults have been taught very carefully to be more sophisticated and even more suspicious of spiritual things in some ways. And so children don't I mean, while certainly children have days when they are not so lovable, as we all do, and children, you know, do have very intense needs, but at the same time, children also recognize the needs in others and often, you know, are the ones who are giving and who are generous and who are lively at times when the adults in the room are not, or
sure,
can't be, or don't even recognize the need to be. And, you know, there's a story about Sarah, who's a child who was born addicted and has been adopted by a family, but still has many challenges physically as well as emotionally because of the circumstances of her development and her birth and ongoing development. And she's the one who says, "God must love me very much," and says it with this great joy.
Yes.
And so, well, I really like your poem, and I'd love to have a copy of it to think about it more deeply. But at the same time, I think there's another side to children that is not explored as much in your poem, and I would hope that maybe you'll write another poem and think about the other side, because all of us are this curious and complex mixture.
Aren't
of,
we? Yeah.
You know, joy and sorrow and anger and generosity, and we all have intense needs, and some of those, you know, some of those are met by the children who are with us and in our midst and around us.
And I really appreciate the stories that you and Reverend Olson tell in this book about the various children in so many different circumstances that the two of you have encountered over your lives. And I think it's very helpful as people may read this book in groups and talk about it and share their own experiences, just the variety of kids. We're talking with Laura Dean Friedrich, who is co-author of the book Weaving, A Just Future for Children, published by the Discipleship Resources of the United Methodist Church and is available for study groups as well as individuals to read. It's an advocacy guide for children, and we're talking today about advocating for children. Let me give the phone numbers again if listeners would like to join this conversation. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana will reach several local lines. And there's a toll-free line available for people outside of this local area because this program is heard throughout East Central Illinois, from really Chicago to west of Indianapolis. So if you'd like to call us toll-free, it's 1-800-222-9455, and I see we have a caller on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Laura Dean. Go ahead.
Good evening. I have dabbled in public policy a little bit, and I'm very interested in advocating on behalf of children. I have found that it's much easier to work with individuals in small groups than it is to get a public body to move. It seems to me that sometimes people who are in positions of power are actually influenced by outside forces. And so I don't know if your book talks about that, but how do you see public policy affecting the well-being of children, especially children that are called at risk, and as that relates to moral issues?
Well, let me start and then see if I'm answering your question or that I've got the question right. I think, for example, I sometimes tell people that I think children are at the heart of every public policy issue. And some people are willing to sort of, okay, maybe, but many people don't see it that way. But I think that when we make decisions, for example, about how much funding there is in education, for example, that's a children's issue. And so in Illinois, for example, we have a school funding system in which there's enormous disparity in how much downstate districts have for educating their children, and how much some districts north of I-80 have for educating their children because of the kind of state funding formula that we have. So that's a public policy issue. We don't have to fund schools the way we're funding them right now. We could change that in a variety of ways, but it's a public policy issue, and the fact that it's how we fund our education system in the state has an impact not only on children right now, how much opportunity they have in their classrooms and how much equipment they have in their schools and what the qualifications of their teachers are, but it has an impact for the rest of their lives in terms of their preparation for higher education as well as their preparation for jobs and participation in the workforce and participation in civic endeavors as well as communities and their own families and so forth. So, I mean, while I agree that it's easier to work with an individual child or a small group of children around, you know, for example, reading or math or whatever, and that's an important thing to do. That's a worthy thing to do. But I think we also need to look at the larger issues, like what's happening in the local school in our own community. What are ways that we can participate in helping to make that a better school or support teachers or get more supplies for the children, but then thinking about the even larger question about school funding.
And Lardine Friedrich, when the caller was asking about public policy, and you responded immediately by saying it all affects children, and it often affects children most. I know you and your professional position as Director of Education and Advocacy at the Protestants for the Common Good in Chicago, you're also concerned about just basic aid to families who are temporarily in need of it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's another one of those public policy issues. There's, you know, a program, we call it TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. And it's for families who are living in very difficult circumstances, families that have very low incomes. Right now, their income would be 33% of poverty. And that's a very low income, but if they live at that level, then they can apply through the Illinois Department of Human Services for receiving cash assistance through the TANF program. Years ago, we used to call it public assistance. The name changed 10, 15 years ago, but it's still the same idea that this is a program that helps people for a short period of time. It gives them an opportunity. They get some help with figuring out employment opportunities or training programs or finishing getting their GEDs or getting started at a community college. But the idea is to help people develop some skills and some employment history and get some income through work that eventually means that family can move out of poverty and be self-sufficient. It's a temporary assistance. And, you know, this is a time of great economic stress in our society. The TANF program is one of those safety nets. Many people who lose their jobs right now are not eligible for unemployment assistance, unemployment insurance, because they weren't working full-time or they hadn't worked in the job long enough or some other kind of technical issues. But the TANF program, if their incomes are quite low, the TANF program is one of the places that they can go for some temporary assistance. Most people are not on the TANF program very long. Most people stay on about 2 years or a little less than 2 years. So it just gives them a little bit of cash assistance to help them get their feet on the ground, help them get involved in work or school training of some kind, and then move on from there to, you know, a better time and a better place for their families.
And again, TANF, T-A-N-F, is Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which is available through the Illinois Department of Human Services. So if listeners themselves or know people who are desperately in need of funds, and families and children in those families are suffering, aid is available, and many people don't know that. So that's very important to know. We have another caller, again, on local line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Can you tell me, do you know what the disparity is now in the amount of funding for students in school? I recollect that it's somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 between the richer school districts up in Chicago and down in East St. Louis. Do you get those numbers?
Well, I can give you some round numbers. I don't have, you know, it varies from school district to school district.
Sure.
And there are several formulas that are used to determine the amount of school funding. But let me just say basically that school funding is in Illinois is it's a state and local partnership primarily. Now we do get some federal dollars for education, but that's a smaller amount. It's about 7% generally comes to the state. 7% of the full cost of the education we're providing in Illinois. Then the state pays about, and this is an average, a statewide average, the state pays about 27, 28, 29% of the total cost. But local districts then, local municipalities, pay the remaining amount comes from dollars that are raised at the local level, and that's primarily through property tax. So obviously, in an area where there's a lot of property wealth, that's an area that has more funding available for their schools because these communities have those resources. When you're in a community that doesn't have a lot of property wealth, then the amount of money that can be raised through property tax is considerably lower. The tax rate may actually be higher, but the amount of money that can be raised is lower. So the disparity that you talk about is the $8,000 to $10,000 is about right. That's probably an average across the state. And it's you know, Chicago, let me just say one thing about Chicago, because it's the suburban communities around Chicago that have the higher property wealth and are paying considerably more for the education of their children than other districts are able to pay.
And Illinois is one of the absolute worst states in the whole country in terms of the disparity between the rich
right.
and the poor districts.
That's correct.
We have a couple callers waiting to talk with our guest today, Laura Dean Friedrich, author of Weaving, A Just Future for Children, an advocacy guide just published. Let's go to line number two. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
I have one question, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
My question is, do you know what the poverty level is in Illinois?
Well, the poverty level is actually established by the federal, at the federal level, and so I don't know all of the figures right off the top of my head, but for example, a family of four is living in poverty if they live below about $21,000 a year, and so the federal poverty level is the poverty level that we use for all the states. Now, that's what I'm understanding the question was.
I think that's right. That's
okay.
Exactly right. And okay. We have another caller again on line number one. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello, is this line one?
Yes, it is. Go ahead.
Okay. I was the one that called a few minutes ago about the disparity in
yes.
Funding.
Yes.
I had a follow-up question for your guest. How do you respond to the frequent argument that essentially boils down to why should we up in the suburbs of Chicago care about other people's children, particularly those down in East St. Louis? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I believe in something called the common good. I mean, I think people should care because all children are valuable. All children have worth, and all families have worth, and we should care what's happening to all children individually and corporately. And as a person of faith, I understand that that's one of the demands of my discipleship, is that I'm called to love and care for all people, not just the people in my own neighborhood. And so that's, you know, that's why I think we should be doing it. I think the other thing is, the reality is that we are talking about not only the lost opportunity for children right now, that they have less resources being invested in their education, but it's also a larger question of the economic development of the state and the ongoing development of the workforce that you know, we are all going to need. As we get older, other people are going to need to take our place in the workforce, and we need for those people to be well prepared for all of the jobs that are out there, whether it's a service industry job or it's one of the jobs in the technological field, which is, of course, growing right now, and that's where many of the jobs are going to be. So it makes sense to invest in all children. And I think that, you know, only a few people suggest, well, the wealthier districts should give money to the districts that don't have as much. I mean, only a few people suggest that. Most people think in terms of how do we provide additional resources for those districts who cannot raise a lot of dollars through their property taxes, so that we have a more equalized education system across the state.
We're just a little bit past halfway in our program today, and Laura Dean, I'll get back to you in a moment. You might look at page 68 of your book if you have it in front of you. I'd like to talk about some very practical ways you analyze how people can be good advocates for children's issues when we come back in just a second. But let me tell listeners a little bit about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks here on Keeping the Faith. Next week, June 7, our guests will be Ann Ramses and Casey Umland, talking about programs for university students here at the University of Illinois. On June 14, we'll be talking with federal judge Joan Lefkow about some of the poetry written by her late mother. Joan and her sister have published a book of her mother's poetry called Simple Things. We'll be reading some from that and talking with Judge Lefkow. On June 21st, Axel Gehrman will be our guest, along with someone else from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation here in Urbana, which is celebrating its 150th year here in this community. June 28th, Lee Malhado will be talking about the actions of the Jewish Federation. We're just at the very end of Lee Malhado's term as director of the Jewish Federation, and want to reflect with her about some of the very important actions that the Federation has been engaged with over these years under her leadership. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although in the next couple weeks I'll be traveling a couple times, and I have some good substitute hosts who will be here, such as Don Nolan, a professor emeritus at Parkland College in Philosophy and Religion. We're talking with Laura Dean Friedrich, and let's get back to her. I should say, this is a program of Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, heard also at 90.9 on the FM dial if you have HD2 and HD3 ways of listening on FM. So, Laura Dean, let's get back to your book called Weaving, A Just Future for Children, and I did find it very helpful as a way through the book, looking at the warp and the woof and thinking about a loom. I have a sister-in-law who's a weaver, so this was familiar images for me, and I thought it was a helpful way into this study. But let's talk about in Chapter 4, where you talk about different types of advocacy. I think this is very helpful. Would you share that with our listeners?
Sure. I think it's important to understand that advocacy has several dimensions. It would be one way to say it, but I sometimes describe advocacy as an umbrella that includes several different kinds of activity. Because often when I ask people, what do you think of when you hear the word advocacy, they tend to jump immediately to legislative advocacy. They'll say things like laws or legislature or bills or elections, things like that. And in fact, Diane and I really believe that advocacy, while that's an important part of it, advocacy is much more complex. And so we've identified four types of advocacy in the book. The first is education, then there's service, then public policy, and the fourth is coalition building. Now, these are not in hierarchical order. This is just the way we listed them, because we think they're all important. So education is what you do to learn about issues that impact the lives of children and families, and what you do to help other people learn about those issues. So it's kind of a both-and type of advocacy. So part of it is your own research, talking to parents, listening to parents, reading articles, going to workshops, and learning things, and then in exchange or in return, then getting that information to people in the local church or in your community or in your social group or your family or wherever, so that you're educating, raising awareness, and helping people understand the kinds of issues that impact the lives of children, and then what kinds of responses there could be from a group of individuals or an individual, for that matter. The second kind of advocacy is service, and this is the programmatic piece. This is where early in the conversation I talked about people in churches see a need, and sometimes they give money, but sometimes they start a program. That's what this is. This is for people who are either starting a program or they're working in a program or they're volunteering in a program that serves children. And that could be, you know, a tutoring program, a summer camp program, an after-school program, a child care program. There are just dozens and dozens of different kinds of programs that serve children. And so these are the service kinds of advocacy. Then public policy is the legislative work, whether that's done at a local level with a town board of trustees or a city council, whatever the local government is, or it can be the county government, or it can be state or federal. But it's the places where decisions are made that affect the lives of children and families. It's where programs, where legislation defines what kinds of programs will be in the state, defines how we're going to fund education, defines how we're going to support people who live in poverty, how we're going to organize our life together as a civic community. And that's the legislative work. That's being involved in voter registration, encouraging people to vote. It's going to the state legislature or to a district office to talk with our elected senators and representatives, or going to the city council and talking to alder people or our trustees or whomever. And then coalition building is when you work with other people. It might be in a community that there's a particular need that you see, and so people organize together. And so it's community organizations, it's churches, it's social service agencies, it's chambers of commerce, other kinds of civic organizations, even social clubs sometimes get involved. Just to give you just a quick example, years ago I was working in a community in which there was an intersection where there were a lot of car accidents because there were no stop signs, no traffic light, cars tended to assume they had the right of way when they went through. And that was a neighborhood where there were a lot of children, and there were children that were using that intersection just like cars were. And so people who worked in agencies, people who lived near that intersection, churches, got involved in an advocacy effort to get a stop sign erected for that intersection, so that the cars would have to stop and would not move through the intersection so quickly. Now, that's a very specific, very concrete kind of example of advocating for children. But that's the kind of coalition building that goes on. And, of course, it can be much bigger issues than just an intersection in a particular neighborhood. So those are the four kinds of advocacy. And what we describe in the book is actually the story of a church that begins with education and then as it learns more about issues related to the well-being of children, they begin to do other things in the life of the church. They move into the other areas of advocacy. And that was over several years. It didn't happen overnight, but they moved from education to thinking about service advocacy, and then they eventually got involved in some public policy and then started thinking about ways they could work with other people in the community on those issues.
Let me point out to listeners that this book by Laura Dean Friedrich and her co-author, Reverend Diane Olson, called Weaving a Just Future for Children, includes study guides so that leaders in small groups can help people work through this, perhaps in churches, Christian education committees, various study groups. And that's really one of your intended audiences. Of course, anyone could read this book and learn something from it. But why did you think this would be particularly helpful in that setting?
You mean in the church setting?
Yes,
or in a study group setting,
in a church setting.
Yeah. Well, I think because of what we have observed so many times in churches, that, first of all, churches always have education programs, and they have programs for children, for teenagers, and certainly for adults. And Diane, you know, is a Christian educator by profession. I'm an early childhood educator by profession, and so we just obviously believe in the power of education, that education can not only enrich somebody's life, but that it can transform a life and people's lives. So we saw that churches are always looking for new programs, new curricula, new challenges for their people, and we thought, well, we want people to learn about advocacy. An education setting is one of the ways to do that. So we try, you know, the study guide is there for people to use. And I guess that it's one of the reasons is also the powerful example we give in that chapter about the church that moves through all those different kinds of advocacy. They started out with a study, and that, you know, fueled a new beginning for that church in terms of its understanding of its ministry and its mission in the community.
This book is published by the United Methodist Publishing Corporation through Discipleship Resources, and you can go to discipleshipresources.org and find out how to order this book. Diane, talk a little bit about why you say we often feel like we're in scarcity in our churches, in our communities, in our religious organizations, and yet you feel we really have many more resources available than sometimes we think.
Well, I think part of that's maybe a cultural impact on the life of the church, because we live in a society in this country that has many resources, and yet we live in a society in which we often are comparing ourselves with others and saying, well, I don't have as much as that person or that family or that community or that whatever. And so we tend to feel that we don't have enough in sort of our, you know, the sort of the daily life part of our existence. But I think another dimension of that is that when we look at the large issues that impact the lives of children, it's easy to be overwhelmed. And so it's easy to think, I don't know what to do about that, or I don't have enough skill, or I don't have enough influence, or I don't have enough money. But in fact, all of us have something to contribute to a larger effort to serve children and to make life better for children. And it sometimes takes a bit of reflection and talking with others to see, oh, yeah, this is something I can do. I can't do this, but I can do this. And then that's where working together, why a study group is important, because a study group is a place where people can say, look, you may not feel like you can do this, but I know you're good at this. And children need that as much as they need this. Or even doing some training so that people feel they, in fact, have more skills and have more capacity, and they can move to places that they didn't expect to go. That's one of the titles of that's the title of one of our chapters, that advocacy is going places we didn't expect to go. Because when people get clear about issues and start recognizing their own strengths and then building new capacity and working with others, amazing things can happen.
You give on pages 138, 139 some very specific things that people can do, like in 10 minutes or less, or or 2 hours or more, or whatever. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, people are busy, and there's no question about that. We live in a very busy world. There are many things to do, many responsibilities, and so we felt like it was important to be as concrete as possible, because it's easy to talk in generalities and say, well, all of us should be advocates for children. But the purpose of this book was to give people not only some vision of being an advocate, but also some tools, some very practical things to do. And so the idea was to say, if you can't, you know, if you can't travel to Springfield, for example, because some people say, oh, I could never do that, and yet sometimes people do it and discover, well, that yes, they can do it, and they can actually be effective when they get to Springfield. But on the other hand, everybody can pick up the phone, or almost everybody can pick up the phone and make a phone call. And if you call a legislator and you say, tell Senator Jones or whomever, Smith, that I'm concerned about this issue and I want him or her to do this, then that has an impact. That phone call, they make note of that, and that information goes to the senator, goes to the representative. And so that's what we tried to do. We tried to come up with some things that you could do quickly. Maybe you don't feel like you can write a letter or even send an email, but you can do a postcard, and a postcard goes through the mail, and that is made note of when it gets to the recipient. We thought that voting is an important way to be an advocate. If you think about children's issues when you're voting, that's important. If you help other people vote, maybe a parent who's got a couple of young children and will have a hard time getting to the voting booth that day. So you offer to take care of the children for half an hour while she goes to vote, or you give her a ride because it's pouring rain. So sometimes it's just very simple things like that. Or something that takes longer is if you go to a candidates forum or go to a town hall meeting to hear about issues and to talk with neighbors and listen to elected officials or candidates for office talk about those issues. You get to ask questions. You get to hear other people's questions. You can work in a coalition. I've already talked about that some. But these are things that are available for most of us. It's just a matter of deciding, I'm going to do this. And once you do the first thing, it gets easier to do it again or to think about something else you can do.
Laura Dean Friedrich has worked with ChildServe and Casa Central and currently is the Director of Education and Advocacy at Protestants for the Common Good in Chicago. And that organization, along with the Community Renewal Society, recently did some very public advocacy in front of the Capitol building in Springfield, and then in organizing people to talk with their legislators about educational funding reform in the state of Illinois. Tell us a little bit about that effort.
Well, we began by developing some principles of education, which say basically that we believe all children can learn, and that all children have a right to a good education, and that the state has a responsibility to provide the means for that education. And when we said the state, we actually spelled it out, that it's not just the governor and the members of the General Assembly, but it's all of us as well, that all of us need to work toward providing a good education for our children. We were particularly concerned about education funding, and so that was the primary focus. We want the state to invest more money in education to reduce some of the disparity that we talked about earlier in the conversation. And we posted our principles and our call to action on our website at Protestants for the Common Good, and we had over 700 people sign on to that. It's like a petition, but our principles and call to action, and they were from all over the state. There are 118 legislative districts in the state of Illinois, and we had people from 95 of the 118 districts sign on. And then we had about 100 people who went to Springfield. We had a brief rally. And then we had people go talk to their legislators and say, you know, quite frankly, we need a tax increase because that's the only way we'll be able to increase funding for education. And so some people weren't able to see their legislators because legislators were in session that day, but they left information at their offices with their staff, and other people did have direct conversations and got a whole range of responses from legislators when they talked with them. And one of my favorite is there was one representative who said when she learned who this small group was that came to visit with us, she said, well, it's good to see that people of faith do something besides just pray. And so it was good to have people of faith actively working to improve things for kids in schools.
We're talking with Laura Dean Friedrich, a co-author, along with Reverend Diane Olson, of Weaving, A Just Future for Children, an Advocacy Guide, a book just out this year. People can learn more about by going online to discipleshipresources.org. Laura Dean, we're down to our last minute and a half. Any last thoughts on this topic of advocating for children?
Well, I started by saying I felt it was a call to ministry, a call to vocation, and that's how we end our book, is by saying that child advocacy is a vocation, it's a calling. And we really believe that it's ordinary people. It's not just elected officials, but it's also ordinary people, people of faith, people of good conscience, who work together in a variety of ways for the common good and for the well-being of children and youth as they are growing and developing and learning and getting ready for the future that awaits them. And so I encourage people to, I'd love for people to read the book, get in touch with me and ask more questions. If you'd like to do that, you can reach me at Protestants for the Common Good in Chicago. But also, if you don't read the book, at least look around your own community and think about the children there.
And we'll have to stop
those issues.
Thank you. We have to stop there, but thank you, Laura Dean Friedrich, and to our listeners and our callers. And thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
Thank you.
Keeping the Faith is made possible in part by the Quaker Meeting of Champaign-Urbana, a local community dedicated to the Quakers' testimony of peace, equality, integrity, and simplicity. The weekly meeting includes silent worship Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. at 1904 East Main Street in Urbana. Online at quaker.org/urbana.
Men are under siege. They might be the stronger sex, but as far as cultural clout goes, they get the short end of the stick. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, why one writer says the feminist movement lost its way and ended up making men the enemy. Is it time to save the males? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening at 7. Next time on the Afternoon Magazine, our monthly look at diet and nutrition. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move will join us. One of the topics we'll take up this time out, diet and eye health. I'm Celeste Quinn. I'll invite your telephone calls for Susan following the 1 o'clock news. The Afternoon Magazine begins at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Please join us.